that holding back two giant-sized hulking monsters would obviously be no problem at all. The Yeti, of course, thought it had the man helpless. Any onlooker would have believed the same. Unless that onlooker understood the skill of the monster's intended victim. From his half-kneeling position, Entreri threw himself over wildly, spinning out to the side ahead of the descending Yeti claw. The beast tried to keep up, stomping its foot in an attempt to pin him down or crush him. But Entreri stayed ahead, and his sidelong spin turned into a forward roll that brought him back up to his feet. He broke aside immediately, dodging the lunging Yeti and whirled around, his momentum strengthening the stab of his sword, the blade tearing through flesh to nick off the thick rib of the beast. With a frightening howl, the Yeti spun around to face him. But Entreri was already gone, out the other way, and he struck again with his sword, but did not plunge it in deeply this time. He stayed ahead of the turning beast, sticking it again, goading it around and around. And as soon as he seemed to become predictable, Entreri stopped abruptly and ducked low, the turning Yeti sweeping its grasping arms up over him as he cut back the other way. From the other side, he leaped up and drove his dagger hard into the Yeti's right armpit, the vampiric weapon slicing through tendon and muscle with ease. And Entreri let his magical dagger drink deeply, stealing the very life force of the huge creature. How it howled! It swung back violently, swinging arm clipping Entreri, who was already diving out and away, and the force of the blow helped him along as he put several strides between himself and his beastly enemy. He rolled back up in perfect balance and turned around, facing the beast. In came the Yeti in a running charge, but with one arm now hanging dead at its side. Entreri charged as well, and at the last second, the beast lunging wildly, he dived aside, managing a slash as the monster tumbled past. A quick turn had him in pursuit behind the Yeti, and he struck with sword and dagger now, chasing it and sticking it repeatedly, never giving it the chance to stop and turn back. His sword bashed against the beast's remaining good arm, but Entreri stabbed with a dagger, poking little holes, inconsequential wounds except that with each bite the vampiric dagger fed. But then the Yeti turned the tables back. It was gone so quickly, it took Entreri a long heartbeat to even realize it had leaped straight up into the air. He ran past and the beast landed heavily behind him and pursued him. Entreri angled for the wall, knowing he could not stay ahead of this foe for long, and in no position to try a blind and desperate dive to either side. He could hear the breaths of the monster so close behind. In front of him, the mountain wall climbed high, barely 5 strides away. But he didn't slow. Instead, he leaped, throwing his shoulders back, running up the stone 1 step, 2 steps, then leaping higher and inverting, backflipping high into the air. He threw his sword as he did, as high as he could, and he came over above the Yeti, which had bent low to grab at him at the last moment. He crashed down atop the Yeti's back, legs straddling, both hands grasping his dagger hilt, and all of his momentum driving that vicious blade straight down atop the Yeti's head. A boulder split asunder by a stroke of lightning would have sounded no louder than the crack of that skull, and the Yeti's legs simply gave out under it. Entreri caught his descending sword and rolled aside, far from the tumble as the beast thrashed crazily in its death throes, the jeweled dagger's hilt still sticking like a unicorn's horn from the top of its head. Entreri took a deep breath and tried to reorient himself, turning back to view the battle. A quick glance to the side showed him his nightmare and the other Yeti locked in a death grip, smoke and blood and torn hair all around them. The nightmare had been pulled down to its front knees, but bit hard at the Yeti's arm as the beast clamped around the steed's head, trying to twist its neck apart. Entreri rushed to retrieve his dagger from the now dead beast, thinking to go to the nightmare while the Yeti was so vulnerable. But a horrid cry sounded from behind, demanding his attention. He whirled around to see another of the Yetis, the one on the same side of the trail as he, frantically thrashing around, tearing its own skin with its claws as spiders climbed out of a gaping wound in its belly. Entreri had witnessed Efren's handiwork before, and he held faith that this Yeti too was out of the fight for the time being. He scanned out toward the center of the trail to see Afafrenfir in full retreat, a Yeti in close pursuit. Entreri yanked his dagger free and started out to help his companion, but before Entreri had gone two steps, the monk cut before one large boulder, and as the Yeti crossed it in pursuit, a form materialized from out of the rock. Ambergris, her melding spell ended, came out swinging. She had both hands on Skullcrusher, her huge mace, and it was obvious that she had seen the Yeti coming from within her meld with the rock, for the level and angle of her sidelong swipe was perfect, sweeping across to crunch the Yeti's knee and sending it sprawling to the ground. Clearly anticipating the move, Afafrenfir was already turning and was fast back to the spot, leaping with a double knee drop onto the back of the prostrate Yeti's head. The monk sprang up and stomped again, then leaped out before the Yeti as it started to rise, demanding its attention. And so the beast never saw Amber coming, as the dwarf landed on its back and executed a tremendous overhead chop with Skullcrusher, the weapon once more living up to its name. One-on-one, Dahlia figured she might have a chance against a tundra Yeti, even though her weapon was not particularly effective against their tough hides and thick bones. When the second beast climbed back to its feet and came forward, though, the elf woman knew that she was in trouble. She banged her staff against the stone before her nearest opponent several times in rapid succession, building a charge, then thrust it out against the returning Yeti and released the energy, driving the monster back a couple of steps. Dahlia thought to turn and flee. Indeed, she started to do just that, but then another form materialized before her and behind the Yeti's as her half-tiefling son slipped out of a crack in the mountain wall and became again three-dimensional. He was already into spellcasting as he reformed, Dahlia noted, so she redoubled her efforts at holding the Yetis in place with a series of jabs and sweeps of Koza's needle. A cloud appeared, sickly green and steaming with putrid aromas, its stench forcing Dahlia back, though it was not aimed at her. It sat in place up above and in front of her, engulfing the heads of the tall beasts. Their arms flailed more at the gases than forward at Dahlia. She heard them choking, half a roar and half a cough, though she could no longer see much of their heads within the steamy, opaque veil of the spell. Dahlia fell back another step, broke her staff into a tri-staff and sent it into a spin. Clutching the middle pole, she launched into a twirling dance, exaggerating her movements to enhance the spinning flow of the outer poles. Her hands lifted and thrust alternately on the center pole, angling the spinning sidebars to crack against the stones and occasionally against each other, throwing sparks that were immediately gobbled up by the enchantment of Koza's needle. Within the stinking cloud, the Yetis flailed. One finally found the good sense to duck low out of the gases, but when it came clear, it began to jolt and roar and twist all around. Behind it, the warlock sent forth black bolts of stinging magic. The whole of the beast burst into flame then, magical dark fire eating at its flesh and hair. Down that Yeti went, streams of smoke rising. The second came forth, though, from the cloud, tumbling over the rock, its chin and chest covered in vomit, but with claws stubbornly raking at Dahlia. She got in a hard blow and let forth her lightning burst to doubly sting the beast. She dropped her hands to the outermost pole and twirled the other two around, whip-like, gathering momentum and speed, then snapping it like a biting snake again and again as the beast stubbornly rose up on its hind legs once more. She felt as if she were beating the dust from a hanging tapestry, and so doing no real damage to the tapestry itself. Dahlia cursed and wished for a broadsword. She cursed some more when the second Yeti stood once again, still burning and smoking, but no longer bothered, it seemed, by the roiling putrid cloud. When it too came forward, moving between the rocks, the elf woman began her retreat, her nearest opponent pacing her, the second closing in. But not closing in on her, she only realized when that trailing Yeti scraped a clawed paw across the back of her opponent's head, and when the leading beast spun around to react, the second leaped upon it, bearing it to the ground. Dahlia fell back, unable to decipher the riddle, until she spotted Efren once more, moving around the putrid cloud and the stones, his bone staff extended, the eyes of the staff's skull glowing red with inner fire. She figured out then that this second Yeti was quite dead, and in death it served Efren. Her son had done this. She watched, mesmerized, overwhelmed, half proud but more than half horrified. The otherworldly shriek of Entreri's nightmare broke that trance and had Dahlia spinning around to see Amber and Afafrenfir standing around another dead yeti. Another beast, still alive, retreated back to the north and tore at its stomach as it went, a trail of spiders crawling behind it in pursuit. And finally, to see Entreri bashing in the skull of the yeti in the middle of the trail, the first of the beasts to appear, as it continued to twist and tear at the throat of the nightmare. The hellsteed now lay on its side, beginning to dissipate into black nothingness. Amber and Afafrenfir rushed up to join Dahlia, and all three turned to regard the nearby struggle. Efren's zombie seemed no match for the living yeti, but it served to keep the beast engaged as Efren once more began to throw his blackfire magic. The living yeti finally managed to extract itself, the zombie falling still, quite destroyed. But the wounded beast had no more heart for the fight, obviously, and it ran off to the north, one last bolt of energy reaching forth from the warlock's bone staff to bite at it as it fled. Formidable! Afafrenfir remarked as Entreri finished off the last of the enemies.
"Thank you," replied the warlock.
"All of us, I mean," said the monk. "A capable band of five."
Efren just chuckled as he walked past the trio.
"Let us not tarry," Entreri called out to them. "Let us be far from this place before those two return, and likely with more friends."
He ended by leaping to the side in seeming alarm, and his motion and gaze had Dahlia, the monk, and the dwarf beside her turning fast. The yeti Amber had killed stood up once more, brains dripping from the back of its exploded skull. It lumbered after Efren as he went on his way to the far side of the trail. A moment later, the eyes of the tiefling's bone staff flared yet again, and the yeti Entreri had killed by the wall shifted and stiffly rose to its feet.
"I'm not much liking this,"
Amber remarked, and the dwarf priestess lifted her holy symbol.
"Get used to it,"
Efren replied without humor, and indeed, with a clear warning in his tone that he would not much appreciate any attempts the dwarf might make to drive his new pets away. The twisted warlock looked to Entreri and bade him,
"Lead on."
Entreri's eyes never left the warlock, or his two new pets. The assassin moved in front of his latest kill and retrieved the obsidian nightmare statuette. He could not summon his mount again so soon after the fight, so he tucked the figurine away into his pouch and waited for Dahlia and the others to catch up.
"Ye keep your beasties far back,"
Amber ordered Efren, as she and Afafrenfir fell into line behind Dahlia and Entreri.
"I'm only telling ye once."
Efren only gave a cynical little laugh. Despite the protests of the dwarf and the clear uneasiness of the others, when they made camp that night, the zombie yetis stood guard. Indeed, Efren kept the beasts beside them all the way through the mountain pass and onto the rolling hills south of the spine of the world, only releasing them back into death when the towers of Luskin came into sight. For even in that scurvy town, such monstrous undead guards would not likely find a warm welcome. They made their way to the city outskirts north of the river Mirar, where a group of the city garrison stood guard at the north gate.
"What business have you in the City of Sails?" asked one.
He looked at Dahlia as he spoke, but with apparent lust, not recognition. She had been a fugitive in Luskin, of course, and quite high in profile, having murdered one of the high captains and taken his enchanted cloak, which she now wore openly. But none of the group seemed to recognize her or any of them, reminding them of the benefit of their multi-year sleep. They had gone to Icewind Dale as fugitives, with many powerful enemies in pursuit, but now nearly two decades had passed.
"Passing through,"
Amber replied, and she moved in close and offered a handshake, cleverly slipping a gold coin into the guard's hand as he accepted her grip.
"Or might be staying, or might be signing on with a ship. Who's to say?"
The guard nodded and glanced back over his shoulder, pointing to a structure not far down the road.
One-Eyed Jack's, he said. That'd be the place for you.
One-Eyed Jack's? Entreri echoed suspiciously, holding out his arm to bar any others from walking past him.
Aye, a fine inn, and a common room for postings, ship or caravan,
the guard replied. Jack's? The assassin pressed.
That's what he said,
Amber interjected, but Entreri ignored her.
The proprietor?
Aye, but that'd be a shortened version of his name,
the guard replied hesitantly.
Jarlaxle,
Amber Gree blurted, catching on. The guard and his companions all blanched and looked around nervously, for such was clearly not a name to be spoken openly and loudly in Luskan. Entreri moved back, signaling his group around him. We go around the city, he told them quietly.
Been wanting a warm bed?
Amber argued. No.
Bah! But I'll meet ye on the other side after one good night,
the dwarf bargained.
No,
Entreri flatly answered, and he pointedly turned away from the guard and mouthed silently to his companions.
Would you so quickly tell all the world that we have returned to the land of the living?
That gave Amber and the others pause. Entreri moved them away, motioning for the guard to remain behind.
You don't believe we can trust Jarlaxle?
Dahlia asked quietly when they were off to the side. Entreri snorted, as if the question itself was perfectly ridiculous.
He saved us,
Dahlia reminded him. Entreri snorted again.
Yet another reason for me to hate him.
We were statues, we three,
half a friend Fear put in, indicating himself, Entreri, and Dahlia, all three who had been turned to stone by a Medusa in the dark environs of the Shadowfell, in the house of Lord Drago Quick.
Trapped forever in nothingness, unable to even go on to our afterlife.
Sounds like heaven, Entreri said dry. We go around the city, all of us, and not another word.
Are you deigning to speak for the whole group now?
Dahlia asked.
As you did in going to battle against Drizzt, you mean?
Entreri quickly retorted, and the woman backed off. The dwarf, the monk, and Efren exchanged glances.
Well, lead on then, ye dolt,
Amber said.
Next city in line. Port last, if she's still standing. I'm in need of a beer and a bed, don't ye doubt.
And a bath,
Afa Frenfear added.
Don't ye get all stupid, grumbled the dwarf.
And with a farewell nod to the confused Luskan guard, the band turned east, around the city, and moved off down the road. Chapter 5 Huzzas and Hey-Hos. A ray of morning sunlight peeked in through the window and tickled Catty Bree's senses. She slowly came out of her wonderful night's sleep. She was naked, but huddled under piles of blankets and delightfully warm. And warmer still as memories of the previous night flooded through her. She reached back behind her at that warm thought, feeling for her companion. He was not there. Surprised, Catty Bree moved up to her elbows and peeked out from under the edge of the blankets. Drizzt was across the room, near the hearth, the flames shining off his ebon skin, orange highlighted reflections showing in his long white hair. He too was quite naked, and Catty Bree took the moment to admire his form, the grace of his movements as he tossed another log onto the fire. It bounced around the half-consumed faggots within and settled too near to the front, and she heard Drizzt sigh as he considered it. She thought he would reach for the poker, but he did not. Indeed, he moved the small iron screen farther off to the side and reached in with his bare hand to retrieve the log, which had not yet caught, though tiny sparks could already be seen within the folds of the bark. Drizzt laid that log aside and turned back to the low-burning fire, bending low, then instinctively jumping back as one burning log popped, sending a spray of sparks up the chimney. Catty Bree muffled her laugh with the blankets, not wanting Drizzt to know that she was spying on him. She pulled the blankets down from in front of her face, though, her mouth hanging wide open, when Drizzt reached into the fire to rearrange the smoldering logs within. He grabbed one glowing log, flames erupting all around his forearm, with hardly a wince, and reset it upon the others. Apparently satisfied with his handiwork, he retrieved the new log he had set aside and carefully placed it on the others. He stood, brushed his hands together, and replaced the screen.
"How?"
Catty Bree asked from the bed, and Drizzt turned to regard her. The woman's gaze moved across the small room to the far wall where Drizzt had hung his sword belt. She noted the gem-encrusted, black cat-shaped pommel of the scimitar Icing Death, which she knew could offer Drizzt such protection from the bite of fire. Had he grown so attuned to the blade that it could lend him such even when he was not carrying it?
"Good morning," he greeted. "Oh, and it is a fine one. Though the stubborn wind of Winter's End bites hard this day, the others are off to gather mounts and supplies."
"How did you do that?"
"Do what?"
"You reached into the fire. It should have curled the flesh from your finger bones."
Drizzt came over to the bed and sat beside her, lifting his left hand to reveal a ring made wholly of ruby, a sparkling red band around his finger. "I took it from a mage, a drow noble," he explained, as he slid it off and held it up for Catty Bree. "In the bowels of Gauntlegrim. It is a long tale and a good one for the road." He reached his hand out, offering the ring to the woman for a closer look.
"It protects you from the flames."
"As surely as my scimitar," Drizzt replied. "Indeed. When first I put it on, I felt a sense of affinity between the two, scimitar and ring. It was almost as if their magic had nodded respectfully to each other."
Catty Bree looked at him curiously and skeptically, for she had never heard of such a thing. Drizzt's weapon, powerful though it was not sentient in any way that she knew, and rings such as this ruby band were not uncommon. Not overly powerful, and not known to possess any type of empathy or telepathy. She handed it back, but Drizzt caught her hand before she could retract it. "In many cultures, the ring is the sign of fidelity and undying love," he explained as he slipped it onto her finger. "Take this in that spirit, and with the added benefit of the protection it offers. With my scimitar in hand, we too can walk across hot coals." Catty Bree looked curiously at the jewel. For just a fleeting second, when it had gone onto her hand, she had felt something. Something like a call from afar, or as if the ring was feeling her as surely as she was feeling it. The sensation was gone in a moment, and then it seemed just a ruby band once more. But one that had shrunken already to perfectly fit her, as magical rings were wont to do. She held her hand up to better view it with the ring on, and looked through her fingers to the violet eyes of the drow she so loved.
"The others are gone?"
she asked.
"They left with the dawn,"
Drizzt replied. Catty Bree lifted the edge of the blanket, and Drizzt didn't need to be invited into the bed twice.
"I thought we had returned for Drizzt,"
Regis said to Catty Bree. But the two at the back of the line of five, as they made their way into the rocky dells around Kelvin's cairn, the long and winding approach to the dwarven complex. He didn't even try to hide the regret from his voice, and Catty Bree caught it, he knew, when she turned to regard him with obvious concern.
"Were you hoping for a fight?"
I was hoping that I would be of use,
Regis replied.
I left much behind me to get to Icewind Dale.
He would have died without us,
the woman replied.
Without you, not me. You arrived armed with healing spells. My potions were not needed. Indeed, I was not needed. Had I remained in the south, the outcome here would have been the same.
You cannot know that, said Wulfgar.
He slowed to let the other two catch up to him. Drizzt and Brunner were far in the distance, already around the next bend.
Something you might have done. Someone you may have met and influenced, perhaps played a part before we ever came upon him atop the mountain.
Or perhaps those assassins we fought on the bank of the lake would have come for me instead, and alone I would have been slain,
Caddybri added. But Regis shook his head, having none of it. His thoughts were to the south, with the grinning ponies. His memories drifted across the sea of fallen stars, to sweet Denala Topolino and a mercantile empire he could claim beside her. It was wonderful to be among the companions of the hall again, of course, but there remained the question of why. Duty had brought him here running, but what duty might that be? To fight a war for Brunner and Mithril Hall? To go and do battle with a vampire? Laudable missions both, he reasoned, but neither seemed above the work he was doing with the grinning ponies. Caddybri stopped her walk and grabbed him by the shoulder to halt him too, then called Wulfgar close to join them.
Drizzt won his fight on the night we rejoined him, she explained. Even if we had not been there and he had succumbed to his wounds, that night victory was his.
Regis looked to Wulfgar for some clarification of the surprising remark, but the barbarian could only shrug, obviously as much at a loss as he.
The battle was for his soul, not his body, Caddybri explained. For the very identity of Drizzt Do'Urden. And such a fight must be won or lost alone. And yet, Mialiki bade us to return and facilitated it, and that is no small thing, even for a god.
Because she knew he would win, Wulfgar put in,
and Regis stared at him, trying to catch up to the reason.
And because he won against the desires of a vengeful goddess, one Drizzt has cheated since his earliest days,
Caddybri added.
This is not ended, I expect. Lolth cannot get his soul, but she will exact retribution, do not doubt.
She will try,
Regis corrected. His voice steeled, his shoulders squared. He was glad that he had kept most of his doubts private, for how trivial they suddenly seemed to him. Yes, he would like to ride beside Dorogardo and the grinning ponies once more. Those were fine years of camaraderie and adventure. And yes, of course, he desperately wanted to find Denala again. He had been away from her for years, yet his love for her had not diminished. Indeed, it seemed to him that he loved her more now than he had when she had forced him to flee the ghost of Ebenso. But even that love had to wait, he resolutely reminded himself. He was only alive again because of this, because of Mialiki. A sharp whistle up ahead turned the trio to see Drizzt back at the bend, waving for them to hurry along. Soon after, the five had crossed into the dwarf complex. Only Drizzt had revealed his true identity, and unlike the snarling folk of Bryn Shander, Stokely Silverstream's dwarves were more than willing to hear the drow's side of the Baelor story. The guards escorted the group straight to Stokely, who was taking his breakfast in proper dwarf fashion, with a heaping plate of eggs and breads and a flagon of beer to wash it down.
"Well now,"
the dwarf leader greeted, rising and offering his hand to Drizzt.
"Heard ye might be about. Some friends of yours came looking for ye. A monk fellow, the pretty Amber Grissel O'Mall."
"Of the Adbar O'Malls," Drizzt said before Stokely could, and the dwarf chuckled and went on.
"They came looking for ye, and surprised we were. Where ye been, elf? Near to 20 years gone by."
"It is a long tale, my friend, and one I am anxious to tell," Drizzt replied.
But trust me when I say that it will be the least interesting of the tales you hear this day. Drizzt nodded from Stokely to the other dwarves in the room, his look begging for some privacy.
Bah! But ye ain't to be trusted, Drizzt,
said another of the dwarves in the room, a mining boss named Junkie.
That's what them of the towns are saying.
Then them of the towns are stupid, Brunner retorted.
We need to speak with you, Drizzt said quietly to Stokely. On my word, and on the graves of Brun... He paused and flashed a little grin. On the graves of Bonigo Battleaxe and Thibbledorf Puent, he corrected. Stokely nodded, considered the words for a moment, then waved the other dwarves out of the room. As soon as they were gone, Drizzt stepped back and swept his arm out toward the other four standing at his side. You know my friends not, and yet you do, Drizzt said.
Eh?
Stokely looked them over, shaking his head, then focusing mostly on Brunner, as would be expected. Soon his inspection became more than a simple perusal, though, for there seemed a spark in the clan leader's eye, as if he should know this young dwarf standing before him but couldn't quite place him. He silently echoed the name Drizzt had just spoken.
Might that I should be introducing myself as Bonigo Battleaxe, Brunner said.
And Stokely scrunched his face up with confusion and fell back a step. And his face unwound as the blood drained from it, as his jaw began to inevitably drop open. I give to you, King Brunner of Clan Battlehammer, Drizzt said.
It cannot be,
Stokely breathed.
Ain't ye seen enough craziness in your life to believe a bit more craziness?
Brunner asked with a great harumph and a derisive snort. Stokely moved up to stand before him, studying him closely. Stokely had never known King Brunner at the age of this dwarf before him, of course, for Brunner was much older than he. But poor flummoxed Stokely wasn't wearing an expression of denial on his face.
I seen ye die in Gottelgrim,
Stokely said.
Put a stone on your cairn meself. And ye was in Mithril Hall when Gandalag came back after 1,000 years of deadness.
Stokely tried to respond, but flapped his lips indecipherably for several heartbeats.
But I seen ye die, he tried to explain. More personal this time. Aye, ye did. And now I'm back. Been back to Gontalgrim, too, and going that way again, don't ye doubt. Any of your boys been there since the fightin'?
Stokely continued to stare at him and didn't seem to register the question for many heartbeats. Then he cleared his throat nervously and shook his head.
No! Them halls be a long walk through the Underdark, and the way's full of damned drow.
He paused and looked at Drizzt.
Words that them drow have taken over the lower tunnels. Aye, they have, said Brunner. Ye meanin' to do something about that?
Brunner nodded, but looked to Drizzt, who was shaking his head emphatically.
Might. In time,
Brunner explained to Stokely.
King Brunner will rouse Clan Battlehammer, then. Much to do, said Brunner. And I'm asking ye now not to be spreading word of me return. If ye be who ye say ye be, more in order than an ask,
Stokely remarked.
If I be who I say I be, and I do, that I'm asking as a friend, and not telling ye as your king.
The two exchanged a long look then, both slowly nodding. Then Brunner stepped back to introduce the others, but before he even started, Stokely rattled off their names. Any dwarf of Clan Battlehammer needed no introductions to the companions of the hall.
What a glorious day it be,
Stokely said soon after, as the shock began to wear off.
Ah, but why, I'm wanting to ask. But it's not to matter. Only that it be. But King Brunner's back from Moradin's hall and dwarf home. A good day for Clan Battlehammer.
Brunner did well to hide his wince at the reference to Dwarfholm, enough so that Stokely didn't catch it. Driz did, though he wasn't sure what it meant. He looked to Catti Bree, who had similarly noted it, and she returned his inquisitive expression with a subtle shake of her head, telling him that this was neither the time nor the place for that particular discussion.
"Here's to 100 years of good days for Clan Battlehammer, then," Brunner said, managing a fair amount of bluster. "So where's your road? Ye meaning to spend the summer with us here in the Dale, are ye?" "Nah, got to be going," Brunner replied. "I just came here to gather me friends, and now we've a long road to walk." "Mithril Hall?" "Soon."
Stokely paused and pondered things for a moment.
"And I can't be telling no one." "Not a one," said Brunner. "I'm asking ye."
"Then why do ye come here?"
Stokely asked.
"Why not just ride out to the south? Are ye needing something from me then?"
"Not a thing."
"Then why do ye come here?"
Brunner put his hands on his hips and pasted on a most solemn expression.
"Because I owed it to ye," he said in all seriousness. "If I'm living another 1,000 years, if I'm back after that for another 1,000 more, I'll not be forgetting the charge of Stokely and his boys in Gontalgrim. Ah, but we were lost, all of us, and all our hopes, and there ye were, Twent beside ye. No king could ask for a better clan, and no friend for better friends, I tell ye. And so I'm owing ye."
"Then you're owing us all, living here under the mountain, for I didn't go there alone," said Stokely.
Brunner looked at him curiously.
"Ye tell him who ye be," Stokely said. "I'll give ye a send-off."
"Oh, and she'll be one to fit the miracle that bringed ye back to us, don't ye doubt. And you get up on the derned table and tell your tale to meself and to all me boys."
"Telling the world presents complications," Drizzt interrupted.
"And ye tell all me boys what ye telled me about keeping our mouths shut," said Stokely.
"It would be better," Drizzt started to say, but Brunner, whose eyes remained locked with Stokely's, cut him short.
"Ye bring many the keg," Brunner agreed, "for I've a long tale, and one begging a huzzah and a hey-ho at every turn."
He clapped Stokely on the shoulder, and the other dwarf smiled from ear to hairy ear and shouted out for the dwarves who waited on the other side of the door.
"Call all the boys in from the mines," Stokely ordered, "and ye tell Fat Gorin to cook us a feast fit for a king."
"Huzzah!" the dwarves cried, as dwarves always yelled when an excuse was offered for libations. No dwarf in attendance that night of the celebration of the return of King Brunner would ever forget it. Dwarves prided themselves on their storytelling, of course, epic adventures laced with solemn songs of long-lost lands and hills of gold, heroic feats tinged ever with sadness and ever gleaming with the hopes that the next round, aye, the next, would bring them to a better place. So many were the songs of old, so many the tales of places lost, places waiting to be found again. But the celebration of King Brunner that night in the smoky halls under the mountain in Icewind Dale started out as a typical celebration, with few understanding that this would fast become a special occasion. Not to the height it became, at least. For when he rose upon the table, the introductions of his friends still ringing in the air with the echoes of huzzah, King Brunner took Stokely's boys to a place they'd never been. His song was not of lament, not of kingdoms lost. Nay, not that night. That night, King Brunner spoke of friendship eternal, of fidelity and fealty, of purpose greater than that of any one dwarf. He spoke of Iruladun and the curse that he meant to make a blessing. He openly admitted to his boys his mistake in not going on to Dwarfholm and begged forgiveness, which came from every corner. He spoke of Mithril Hall and of Adbar and of Felbar, of King Conorad and Emerus Warcrown and Harbrum's twins who ruled in Adbar.
He spoke of the Silver Marches and of an orc kingdom that should not be. And he wound it all back to Gontalgrim, to Delzoon, the heritage, to all that had been, and to all that must be again. Not all that could be, but all that must be. And he was King Brunner, the living legend, and so when he said it, the dwarves of Clan Battlehammer believed it. And when he said it would be so, so they determined they would make it so. And the flagons raised, and the cheers echoed, and the flagons raised again.
Ah, but the dwarves, always up for a toast,
Regis remarked, sitting in the corner at the back of the hall beside Wulfgar. Wulfgar gave him a wry smile and said with sly irony,
You only live once.
Twice, Catti Bree corrected, and she slid into the chair between the two.
Aye, Wulfgar agreed. And for some, it seems, it takes the second turn around to understand the joy of it.
Both Regis and Catti Bree looked at him curiously, and looked at each other, each offering a shrug.
I loved you, you know, Wulfgar said, and Catti Bree's expression turned to one of sympathy and sadness.
Oh, no,
Regis whispered under his breath.
Honestly. And with all my heart, said Wulfgar.
Wulfgar, she started to reply, her eyes scanning as if searching for some way to stop this course. But Wulfgar pressed on.
I just wanted you to know that.
I do. I did,
she assured him. And she took his hand and stared into his eyes, and he into hers. And a great grin spread over his face.
My heart does not ache, he said.
Catti Bree looked at Regis again, neither having an answer. Wulfgar burst out laughing.
Am I missing a finer tale than the one Brunner is telling again?
Drizzt asked, moving up to the table.
No,
Catti Bree said.
You are missing an apology, my friend.
Wulfgar said. Drizzt moved to the chair opposite Catti Bree.
An apology? I was simply telling your wife that my love for her was honest and true,
Wulfgar said matter-of-factly.
And it still is, then? Asked Drizzt.
Wulfgar laughed again, heartily, without the slightest hint of sarcasm or regret to be found.
Aye, he said. Aye. How could it not be?
Drizzt didn't blink.
Look at her, Wulfgar cried. As beautiful as the sunrise, as warm as the sunset, with the promise of peace close behind. Would you have me lie to you and tell you that I have no love for fair Catti Bree? Would that make it easier for you to travel the road beside me?
Yes, Catti Bree said, at the same instant that Drizzt emphatically answered no. Drizzt and Catti Bree turned to each other, both appearing as if they had been slapped with a cold, wet towel.
I'll tell no lies to make our journey more comfortable, Wulfgar said. Of course I love her. I always have and I always will.
Wulfgar,
Catti Bree started to reply, but he spoke right past her.
And I'll always love him, fool dwarf. Who gave me a life with mercy he ever denies he possesses, and you,
he added, looking to Regis.
Once I'd travel to the end of Faerun to find you, and I would do so again with a song on my lips, and should I die trying, then know I died well.
He turned to Drizzt and held up his huge hand, and Drizzt took it.
And you, my brother, my friend,
Wulfgar said.
Do you fear my love for your wife?
Drizzt stared into Wulfgar's eyes for a long time, and gradually his lips curled into a confident smile.
No. I would never betray you,
Wulfgar said. Drizzt nodded.
Never,
Wulfgar said again. He glanced over at Catti Bree.
Nor would she, of course, but then you know that.
Drizzt nodded.
You spoke of a second time around, Caddybree said, drawing their attention. What have you learned?
Wulfgar grabbed her hand and brought it to his lips for a gentle kiss. My friend, he said, I have learned to smile.
Caddybree looked to Drizzt and to Regis, the three passing around a grin none could quite decipher.
And now, if you will grant me your pardon, Wulfgar said, hoisting himself to his feet with great effort, and clearly, he had offered more than a few huzzas and hey-hos of his own through Brunner's continuing tale. He nodded his chin to the far corner of the room, and following that motion, the friends noted a dwarf lass staring back at him.
A pretty thing, and I've always wondered, Wulfgar said with a laugh.
Truly?
Regis said.
Wulfgar straightened his shirt and pants, turned back to the halfling, and winked. You only live once, eh? He sauntered away.
Regis gave a little snort, shaking his head.
Go and watch over him,
Caddybree bade the halfling. But as Regis started to stand, Drizzt put a hand out to stop him.
What do you know?
Caddybree asked him. Drizzt was still staring at the departing barbarian. I know that he is content. His heart is full. Caddybree started to argue, but stopped before a single word had come forth. She looked back at Wulfgar, noting the unmistakable lightness of his step.
He completed his journey the first time,
Caddybree remarked, as much to herself as to the others, thinking those words would solve any riddle here. But when she turned back, she found the other two both staring at her to elaborate.
He was married with children,
she explained.
Grandchildren,
Regis added.
All gone now.
So he lived by the rules and traditions, said Caddybree.
He did his duty to his people and to his god.
And now?
Drizzt asked. Caddybree looked back at Wulfgar, who was dancing with a young dwarf lass by then.
Now he will play, she said. It's all a game to him,
Regis said, nodding as he reasoned it out.
Time borrowed from the calendar of the gods for pleasure and adventure, beyond what any man could ask or expect or hope to know. He is free,
Caddybree said, as if only then understanding it. Drizzt looked at the big man and found, to his surprise, that he envied Wulfgar at that moment. But that moment passed, and instead the drow determined that he would learn from his large friend. For in looking at Wulfgar, Drizzt couldn't deny the light, the joy which surrounded the man like a halo sent from the gods.
With a burst of heartfelt laughter, Drizzt lifted his hand and snapped his fingers, gaining the attention of a dwarf handing out flagons. Why not indeed?
Chapter 6 Daermon and a Shesbernon.
Driders, the soldier reported. A trio, at least, holed up in the rear chamber of the former chapel.
Matron Mother Quenthal looked to Gromf.
Milarni,
he confirmed. Quenthal Beanri looked to Vidalma Tlabar, one of the other three matron mothers who had accompanied her this day. Vidalma had ruled her fanatically devout house, Feant Labar, for less than a century, but in that time had earned herself an amazing reputation for sadism and promiscuity. She would copulate with anything or kill anything, so it was said, and sometimes at the same time. And Vidalma was always plotting, Matron Mother Quenthal knew, much like Vidalma's dead mother, Jenny Tiroth. Yes, like her. The memories of Ivanel, given to Quenthal by the Illithid, explicitly warned of the fanatical Tlabars.
Should I have them killed, then?
Matron Mother Quenthal asked her three escorts.
Yes,
Matron Misery Miserim of the fifth house answered immediately, drawing a laugh from Xerath or Lauren. Misery pointedly looked to Vadalma as she answered. Misery had heard the rumors, too, the others understood, for by all whispered accounts, a quiet alliance was being forged. House Flayant Labar and House Malarn considered the two most fanatical in their devotion to the Spider Queen, but each taking their rituals and practices in different directions, were hardly friendly with each other. Their priestesses at Erech Tynalith argued constantly, sometimes violently, over the proper ways to show their love of Lady Lolth. Still, despite the disputes, the quiet whispers about Menzo Baranzon now hinted that Matron Vadalma had recently been approached by agents for House Malarn, offering a truce of sorts. It made sense, as these four matrons understood all too well. With House Sorlaren leaving, there would be a major opening on the ruling council. And every house below Zorlaren would vie for that coveted position. Perhaps House Malarn would go to war with House Misrim, the fifth house, then ascend to the fourth rank as House Feant Labar, House Malarn's secret ally in their endeavors against Misery's family, climbed into the vacant third spot.
Matron Vadalma?
Matron Mother Quenthel asked innocently.
I do not think it wise to destroy Driders of any house, or of no house at all. The Tlobar leader answered. They suffer by living. That is why they are Driders.
Matron Mother Quenthel turned her smirk to Gromf.
She has a point, the Archmage agreed.
Flush them out and capture them, Beanri ordered. Take them in webs to House Beanri for retraining.
Matron Jindia of House Malarn will protest,
Xerath Cusor Lauren warned.
But then she is always protesting, is she not?
How many have we defeated already who are quietly associated with her house?
Matron Mother Quenthel asked. And she moved to the balcony of the loft and looked down over the wide audience chamber below, where the defeated resistance, some alive and shackled, others dead and piled, had been brought.
By what right does Matron Malarn utilize this place?
She spun on the others fiercely.
By what right do they enter here in this most cursed of locations?
Until now?
Matron Xerath asked, right on cue. She and Matron Mother Quenthel had practiced this very exchange, after all.
Until now,
Matron Mother Quenthel replied.
Now we are sanctioned by the goddess. So says First Priestess Sosumtu Beenri, who is First Priestess of the Fane of the Goddess, which is near to this place.
And so says First Priestess Kiri of Zorlaren, said Xerath.
And Sabah, First Priestess of Misrim.
Misery was proud to add, turning to Matron Tlobar with a smug expression as she spoke. And why shouldn't she appear so? Matron Mesbaris Armgo hadn't been invited along. Indeed, it was likely that some of the wayward dark elves the Beanri forces had chased out of this compound had belonged to House Barazin Del Armgo, while others had been merely houseless rogues, and most others had been of House Malarn. If the rumors of House Malarn trying to ally with House Feant Labar were true, and it seemed from Vadalma's sour expression that such was indeed the case, and that House Feant Labar was entertaining the possibility, this expedition had likely put a screeching end to that unified march.
And First Priestess Luathe of Feant Labar,
said Vadalma, clearly trying to bring some determination and exuberance to her tone. Matron Mother Quenthel almost laughed at her.
Almost.
Just close enough so as to let the others, Vadalma included, know that she wanted to laugh at her. But out of deference to Vadalma's station, the temperate Matron Mother Quenthel had restrained herself. Matron Mesbaris Armgo paced around her chapel, huffing and snorting and shaking her head.
"What are you about, Quenthel?"
she whispered to herself.
House Bayenry had sent a sizable force to Westwall, to the old Doerden compound, scouring the place, and beside Quenthel had gone the matrons of the three houses ranked immediately below Bayenry and Barrison del Armco. It seemed an almost unprecedented power play, so startling from the weakling Quenthel, a warning to any houses thinking to climb into the top hierarchy that any such attacks would be met by a unified alliance of overwhelming power. And perhaps it was, as well, a threat to House Barrison del Armco. Matron Mesbarris did not fear any of the other houses individually. Even House Bayenry would never openly attack her, but cost would prove far too high. But all four of these together? Might this be the start of a great realignment, the creation of a grander tie between Manzo Berenzon and the fledgling city of Cusor Lauren before Matron Xerath and the rest of her family departed for their new home? Weapons Master Malek Doral entered the chapel then, his stride fast and anxious. He nodded back at Matron Mesbarris's inquiring look. "Witch," Mesbarris said under her breath. Malek Doral had been sent to Mele Magvir to speak with spies House Barrison del Armco had placed about Almond Bayenry, Quenthel's son. It was an open secret in Menzo Berenzon that House Bayenry had sanctioned House Zor-Lauren's journey to the complex known as Gontalgrim. But in light of these new developments, Mesbarris suspected more than a simple sanction. Malek Doral's nod spoke volumes. Quenthel had arranged that expedition, Mesbarris knew now. For as she had suspected, the brash upstart warrior, Tiago Bayenry, had traveled with the Zor-Laurens. Tiago was the grandson of Weapons Master Dantrag, whom Mesbarris hated. Dantrag had been the greatest enemy and rival of Yutha Gentol, her beloved warrior son, the greatest Weapons Master Menzo Berenzon had ever known, so Mesbarris believed and preached.
"Golfanin too," Malek Doral said,
and Mesbarris nodded, her lips disappearing in a profound scowl. Golfanin, the greatest blacksmith in the city, had traveled with Tiago Bayenry to the legendary forge of the Delzoon Dwarves. Mesbarris could well imagine what that might portend. She looked at Malek Doral pitifully and dismissed him with a wave. Did he understand, she wondered? Did her rather dim-witted grandson realize that Tiago would come back armed to kill him? No sooner had Malek Doral departed than First Priestess Teirul poked her head in through the ornate door. "Manol and Fay has arrived, matron," she said quietly. "Take her to my private chambers at once," Mesbarris answered, quietly. "And let no word go forth that she is here. House Malarn will likely come calling soon enough. Matron Jindia is surely outraged by the brash move of Quenthel Bayenry, and no doubt House Malarn has lost many foot soldiers this day. Driders and captured drow foot soldiers were just carted from Westwall to Quellart Zor," Teirul solemnly replied. "To House Bayenry, it is presumed." Matron Mesbarris snorted and shook her head. Quenthel had truly surprised her with the boldness of this move. She had never thought the sniveling Bayenry whelp was possessed of such courage. To openly abduct Malarney driders. "Put the garrison on war footing," Matron Mesbarris said suddenly. Teirul's red eyes widened. "Matron?" It had been an impulsive command and one of great consequence, but as she considered the events transpiring, Mesbarris found herself agreeing with that impulse even more. "Recall all of Barrison del Armco, noble and commoner. Close the gates and prepare every defense." "Matron," Teirul said with a respectful bow, and she scurried away, leaving Mesbarris alone with her worries. Soon after, before matron mothers and their elite escorts rejoined Archmage Gromph in the wide nave of the two-story chapel of House Doerden. Only a short while before, the four had watched, matron mother Quenthel and matron Misery with great amusement, as the three driders,
cocooned in webbing, were dragged past them by struggling foot soldiers.
"It has been so long since I looked upon this place," Matron Mother Quenthal said. "I had forgotten how much it resembles the Bayenry Chapel, although far less magnificent, of course. Indeed, it is amazing that a house with a chapel of such design